You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the Insurgent Radio
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker, right here on May the 29th, 2014. Yeah, we got a new moon out there. How about that? Or is that a full moon? I always get mixed up. This is Thor's Day here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana. Near Warsaw, Indiana, but pretty close to the woods out here where the mushrooms are growing. You ever go hunt mushrooms? I used to hunt them all the time in the spring with my dad. He used to get mad because he used to almost always find more than I did. Boy, I'll tell you, that burnt me up. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And our big website is resist.com. And that's where you can download all kinds of books and all kinds of information and songs and our radio archives. And if you want to get into some of our ancient stuff that we're starting to put up there, if you'd like to send in a $5 extra a month onto your 20 for the radio show, we'll give you a password. You can go in there and roam around. So we're just getting started on that one. Well, here's some late law for you, boys and girls. Drivers, that's automobile drivers, have a First Amendment privilege, I won't say right because I don't believe in rights, to peacefully film traffic stops. The First Circuit ruled, denying police officers immunity from civil rights suit. The incident issue involves a March 2010 traffic stop on South Stark Highway in Weir, New Hampshire. Carla Garrick was following a friend, Tyler Hanslin, to his house when Sergeant Joseph Kelly pulled Hanslin over for a traffic violation at approximately 11:30 p.m. Hanslin revealed that he had a firearm in the car, so Kelly told him to get out of the vehicle. Garrick, meanwhile, had pulled into a nearby middle school parking lot to wait. Standing roughly 30 feet from Kelly, she pulled out a video camera and told Kelly that she was going to record the stop. Unbeknownst to Kelly, Garrick's camera malfunctioned and would not record, but she continued to point the camera in his direction. The Boston-based Federal Appeals Court noted that this technical glitch does not alter its May 23rd ruling. Garrick claimed Kelly never asked her to stop recording or to leave the area. But when Officer Brandon Montpellier arrived on the scene, he arrested her for unlawful interception of oral communications and seized her camera. The charges were quickly dropped, but Garrick filed a civil rights suit against the officers and the town. Her case went to the three-judge appellate court after a federal judge denied the officers qualified immunity. The officers argued there is no First Amendment right to film police officers during a late-night stop. When the officers faced two cars, each containing a driver and a passenger, one of whom had a gun. Writing for the court, Judge Kermit Lopez said that even if Kelly had ordered Garrick to stop filming, Such an order may only be constitutional if the officers can reasonably conclude that the filming itself is interfering or is about to interfere with his duties, unquote. Garrick's version of the events does not establish the possibility according to the ruling. Under Garrick's account, she was permissibly at the site of the police encounter with Hanslin, Lipitz wrote. Quote, it would be nonsensical to expect Garrick to refrain from filming when such filming was neither unlawful nor the subject of an officer's order to stop. In the absence of such restrictions, a reasonable police officer necessarily would have understood that Garrick was exercising a clearly established First Amendment right. So if you get stopped, and if you're around, you want to videotape a police officer on a stop, as long as you're not physically interfering, you can go back to use this case. So remember that. They can arrest you, but they're going to be subject to probably civil rights lawsuits if you want to go all the way. In other words, just because you're there videotaping what the officer is doing does not make any case that you're interfering with the officer. So there you go. Well, allegedly, the young man who shot up all those people up there in California, I got a comment here from one of our lone wolves out there. The UCSB terrorist's mom looked like a mongoloid Asian, and he especially hated fair, blonde, fair women. So there you go. Well, here's a little more on the veteran situation. Based on open books data, the IBD piece spotlighted bonuses at the troubled VA facilities under federal investigation. Veterans have died after being waitlisted for appointments, yet employees were cooking the books on efficiency numbers. This is from Investors Business Daily. In 2013, only about 1 in 4 of the Heinz 4,230 employees were those providing the actual primary care. Doctors, there were 309, or nurses, about 800. Open books found that. In Chicago, $1 billion in salaries were supplemented with $4 million in bonuses over a 3-year period to VA employees. One bonus out of 3,170 employees at Phoenix, $9,345. The number of avoidable deaths was higher than at nearly any other hospital. That was in Phoenix. At the 7 most troubled VA facilities, almost $9 million in bonuses were paid out to 13,000 employees. Nice work if you can get it. This would be like giving a bonus to the management and players of the last place Chicago Cubs. What the VA executives must answer as to why every veteran didn't receive world-class health care, unquote. Yesterday, and many in the national media sourced opened the books when referenced VA spending. Here's a sample. Rush Limbaugh's show did an entire segment. National Review's Morning Jolt by Jim Garrity wrote, "Don't get distracted. VA scandal is still unresolved, still an outrage." WND's Alan Cook and Bill Andrew wrote detailed reports worth a good read. VA hands out millions of bonuses. VA execs took home millions in salary. And still, people like John Boehner, the Speaker of the House with the Republican Party, who I've told you the Republican Party, the Republican leadership has blocked every pro-veteran bill for the last 15 years, and he still wants to keep this half-Jap on the payroll. Yeah, he's not a white guy, the guy that's running the VA, some kind of a mixed-breed Asian. So, but he still won't fire him. Oh, that wouldn't serve any purpose. That's funny when you talk about other people having jobs. If they screw up, the first thing they do is they get canned. one good thing, if it's true, they say now they're going to take all these people who have been waiting for quite a while and send them out to private medical service, medical doctors. So that could be a good thing. And don't forget to check into this website, openthebooks.com, American Transparency, because you can find out where the money went, where it's going, what on there. It's a good website to keep in your files. Well, the imagined look and persona of an agent provocateur in most people's minds probably couldn't be further from the truth. Most would probably picture the obscure, silent individual lurking in the back of the room while doing his best to conceal his identity and his movements. If you accept that image, you have also accepted the notion that the provocateur is really just peeking in on, documenting, and recording pre-existing criminal activities and shady plans going on around him. You haven't faced the reality that the whole show is the production of the provocateur. Once you realize the momentum, the force, the ideas, and the infrastructure of an event are suggested, put in motion, paid for, forcefully or charismatically insisted upon, managed and facilitated by the provocateur, then you look to very different individuals when considering who is the state's agent provocateur. Looking for those individuals' causes, you too look for these displaying characteristics of a leader, a financial sponsor, an employer, a boss, an orchestrator, or a charismatic friend to a lonely person. Following are 11 characteristics that may be displayed by the provocateur. 1. Is at the front of the room. He is the most visible person in the activity. He is the center of everything, the linchpin. 2. Is the biggest talker. He talks endlessly about illegal activity with no attempts to conceal his attended activity. The provocateur doesn't, as some must think, randomly stumble into a lot of evil debate societies where he is welcomed warmly into open discussions on criminal conspiracies. On his face, that notion should be counterintuitive to most people based upon their life experiences. Even private criminals rarely, if ever, speak specifically to anyone, even to their family or inner circle, about the details of criminal acts they plan to carry out. Talk is at a minimum, and objectives are not openly stated but understood. The provocateur, on the other hand, rants incessantly about criminal ventures and seeks head nodding, mumbling, smiling, or something that he can describe to prosecutors as assent to or participation in the planning of a conspiracy or the execution of a criminal act in furtherance of a conspiracy. Real criminals will quickly decide to get out of Dodge when confronted with a showy loudmouth nut job that is either cop or will get everyone thrown in a slammer. That leads us to the third characteristic. Is fearless of the consequences. Most people fear financial harm, harm to their reputations, and physical harm like imprisonment or being shot. Not the provocateur. He has all that covered. He has his get-out-of-jail-free card. 4. Pays more than things are worth. The provocateur often is not concerned about getting good value for his money. He often buys and pays for things and gives them away for free to his targets, with no sense of quid pro quo. In San Diego, California, when I lived out there in Southern California, we had an infiltrator in the late 70s when I ran the Klan. He ran his business was a construction company that had fallen on hard times, but he was extremely generous. He hosted parties for us. He loaned us Winnebagos to travel around the state. He loaned us communications equipment. Whatever we wanted, we could get from this guy. And, of course, by that time, we knew he was an agent. And we found, we proved he was an agent, a provocateur, by going to his civil files in the court and finding his wife had divorced him and was asking for part of his police retirement money. And which we figured pretty quick who he was. He's never good at getting good value for the funds spent. The same goes when provocateurs spend taxpayers' money. They pay their targets too much for drugs, too much for bomb-making supplies, too much to rent a warehouse to store illegal material, and too much for their time. Well, in the California case, in this particular case, it was funny because, and I've reiterated this before, this guy worked really hard for us, and we milked him for everything we could get out of him, especially after we found out he was an agent. And he worked with me on my 1980 campaign for Congress, of which I won the primary there in the 43rd Congressional District, with his help. And he was a Republican. I was running as a Democrat. I was short of a few names for getting on the ballot. And he went out among his own friends, got them to sign the petition to get me on the ballot. So all this money he was spending on us came right out of the San Diego County taxpayers' funds. And also, he was responsible for getting me into the election that I won, the primary, and it was international news. So, if you could find somebody like that and milk them, good, but you got to be real careful when you're doing it. Again, they spend too much money to rent a warehouse or to store illegal material, and too much for their time. There is no sense of value for value. The overspending is also an inducement to get targets to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. This is a strong signal that a provocateur is involved with something. Is somebody offering to rent a hotel room or a warehouse out of the blue for a venture that cannot be cost-effective at the exorbitant rates being paid by the provocateur? This is not how the mafia or other private criminals think or act. It's a sign of state action. He or she prefers to talk to his car or a hotel room. Talk in his car or a hotel room. Cars and hotel rooms are often wired with audio and video before scheduled meetings. Remember, the Mahan, who's in prison now, 40 years, they had been using a woman, a trampy woman out there in Arizona, to record him in her trailer for 2 or 3 years before they could get anything on him. The provocateur tries to discourage discussions with the target in the target's private controlled surroundings or outdoors where stray noises like traffic or wind will overwhelm a recording. He tries to draw the target to his car or other choreographed location like a hotel room, a warehouse, a garage, and so on, in a theater production controlled by the provocateur. Now, back when I ran the Klan, almost every informant that I ever caught or ever found out about it liked to wear a beard. And in the Klan, of course, that was no big deal because a lot of guys wore beards. And that was a good cover for them. And then if there were arrests made of anybody, when the trial came, they'd be clean shaven. But they used the beard to disguise themselves. I flushed out two of those kind of guys near my home. They came into one of our gatherings, and they were both had beards. They had plenty of money, and had gold chains around their neck. And we immediately laughed about it, and they went on their way because they weren't getting any place with us. So they went up to L.A. and they rented a warehouse deal like they're talking about here. And they started inviting these skinheads to come down there. And I told one skinhead was sort of our eyes and ears up there to warn these kids off because it's a setup. He went down and looked it over and said they had cameras all over the place, closed circuit TV, and they were buying steaks and the best beer and everything for these guys, attempting to suck them in. They finally did suck some young guys in and got them on an alleged conspiracy to bomb and shoot up the first AME black church in downtown L.A., one of the main black churches. Of course, why would anyone want to do that when you want racial separation? You want the blacks to go their way and be in their buildings and their churches. But anyhow, they prosecuted about four, I believe, as I recall. Now, the word was out. I put the word out long before they got busted to stay away from these guys. They were federal agents and informants and so forth. But there's so many people in the right wing will never listen to you. They just won't listen to you. They always know more than you do. The provocateur may be very friendly, or the infiltrator. They're not always a provocateur. Infiltrators, a lot of times, are just in there to gather information, not so much to suggest and lead you to illegal activity. The CIA used to call them a thermometer. They're just in the group to keep track of what you're saying and what's going on, as opposed to a provocateur who's trying to get you into some kind of activity. The provocateur may be very kind and overly interested in the target, believe me, even though the target is an unlikely candidate for his friendship. Oh, they'll go out of their way to loan you money or just about anything. They're going to be your best buddy. Best buddy. And I've over the years, everyone that turned out to be an informant or an agent like that, were always super guys. They're your best friend. They'd follow you into hell and back until they got you in their web. 7, often looks and acts like a member of a demonized group. Sometimes the provocateur overtly displays the characteristics or the talk of a group that is being demonized by the state and the state-supporting media. Say, for example, that gun owners, white supremacists, motorcycle clubs, militia members, devout religious practitioners, or persons of Middle Eastern origin are in the crosshairs of the state, fear-mongering. Well, then it could be anticipated the provocateur may be flaunting grossly exaggerated characteristics of these groups in conjunction with wild rhetoric that would make them a target for the feds if he weren't already in cahoots with them. The more he fits the stereotypical image of that particular mythical dragon the government wants to slay, and more likely that he is putting on a costume to fit an adopted persona. That was that way, especially when I was running a Klan. The guys came in thinking this is what you wanted to see. They'd send in biker types, mountain men types with beards and all that kind of stuff, and guys that are really rough. And, and of course, that wasn't the kind of guys we were looking for. But I did get some of those guys in the Klan in California. In fact, those are the guys that put out a contract to kill me over a situation where they had already killed two of my men. But they were the police were hot on their trail and picked them up before they could carry it out. So cops are not always bad news. He isn't usually a government employee. You may think, I know this guy. I know he's scum, so I know he wouldn't be hired as a law enforcement officer because of his criminal history or other baggage. This sociopathic petty criminal ne'er-do-well is actually the type that is most often approached to be a provocateur. He's often approached by the government and offered an escape from consequences of other activities he's been involved in. This, ironically, is also the type who has the most to gain and the least to lose. By lying and distorting, a provocateur is often recruited on the fly and is told, sometimes with only comments of instruction from a government employee he has just met, to arrange and carry out an event to bring in more defendants in order to save his skin. And that's the case. In most cases, that's the ones they use. I've seen it over and over and over again. Somebody's got charges against them and they agree to deal with the system. Now, you've seen that on TV where they'll let the small fry off if he'll turn in his boss, you know. After he works his way out of a jam. Now, one way you can detect some of these people is you go pull the files. They're criminal files, misdemeanor and felony, and civil files in the area where they've lived quite a while. And unless they've cleaned the files, which they sometimes do, it'll tell you quite a bit. In fact, it'll tell you quite a bit if they're pretty rough characters and there's nothing about them in the criminal or civil or misdemeanor files, then you know something's up, because most of these kind of guys have been in trouble before. After he works his way out of a jam, he often keeps working for money, since he now knows how to produce the desired results. Yeah, these guys, they go on to become professional spies and agent provocateurs. Others are motivated only by the money they receive from the government. Many provocateurs are unwitting lower-tier provocateurs that are paid for their actions by another private provocateur who is receiving funds directly from an actual government employee. This unwitting provocateur doesn't know he's working for the government. He will be paid by the primary provocateur to do things that the main provocateur doesn't want to do, like light a fuse and then run away from a truck without knowing that the government is paying the bills. Often the most damaging evidence at a trial is characterizations of individuals' motivations, statements, and actions. At that point, a government employee is usually called in as an expert witness to analyze, describe, and translate what it means when someone nods their head in sync with a person paying for the beer. Persistence followed by silence. He may exhibit periods of aggressive, nonstop interest followed by days of silence. He disappears. He can't be contacted. He doesn't answer the phone or email. He's seemingly in a mad rush and anxious to conclude a suggested and planned out job. Actually, a planned out transaction or event, despite any consideration of the cost, but then makes last minute lengthy delays. I know some guys like that, and I keep them at arm's length. Some have used the lone wolf excuse that they disappear for months at a time. Hard to get a hold of. They sort of talk around the edges of illegal activity. I got my eye on one right now. He was seemingly in a mad rush and anxious to conclude a suggested and planned out transaction or event, despite any consideration of the costs, but then makes last minute lengthy delays while being incommunicado. That happens because he is conferring with overlords to arrange the final arrest details during the moments or after the moments when he provides illegal material or facilitates an immoral event that will become an overt act of conspiracy needed by the prosecutors. Now, you must understand the three elements. Of course, nowadays with this Homeland Security, who knows whether it's the same. You got three elements. You got the coming together and talking about something, meeting of the minds, and then the second stage is planning the event, like going out to kill somebody or whatever. And the third is an overt act towards completing this conspiracy. Now, most of the time, if people just meet and talk and don't actually make a physical move towards completing the act, they're not going to be arrested. However, that's very tricky. That's extremely tricky because it's getting more and more, well, they'll make arrests anyhow. So look at Matt Hale up there in Chicago. Now, his right-hand man, his security man, talked to him about, allegedly talked to him about killing federal judge or federal judge's family or something. And as far as I know, there was no overt move to actively carry out that threat. But still, he's doing 40 years. So, if somebody's, if you come together and some guy wants to talk heavy stuff like doing something really, really bad, you better get on out of there. And also, one way to find these guys is to say, look, you want to talk about illegal activity? Take all your clothes off. Because invariably, they'll have a wire on them, a tape recorder or something. So, anyhow, that's sort of embarrassing. That sort of reminds me of the one Robert Shelton of the United Clans of America told me years ago, and I've told you before, when we were at Bob DePue, the head of the Minutemen, when we were in Norbourne, Missouri, having a national conference, Shelton took me into his Winnebago, and he was showing me his lie detector equipment, of which we later got the same equipment. And he said that he would come to these Klan gatherings, these small local gatherings that occur in the homes. He would show up unexpectedly or have someone show up unexpectedly. And one night he went to this place and said, well, tonight's the night. Everybody's going on the box. And one guy ran right through a plate glass window getting out of there. Yeah, that's fun. As law enforcement surveillance or arrest teams are put into place during various phases of the developing conspiracy, with all the delays of a bureaucracy, the provocateur drops all contact with targeted victims during crucial times after a deal has been paid for and set up by him. The underlings have been told what to do and when to do it, but can't find their boss during that crucial phase because he is lying low while pestering law enforcement teams who want more time to get ready. Stall and delay is the message to the provocateur from his paymaster. When the provocateur has used up all his excuses and the 11th hour has arrived, he often goes underground and waits for the arrest team to do their thing. After all, he doesn't want to get beat up and shot in the final H-hour bedlam when he is confused with the targets. That reminds me of, I didn't have my recorder on. I told about a deal in San Diego. There was a deal in San Diego years ago when I was running the Klan where some people from San Diego, senior citizens who had been good friends, were being harassed by Mexican gangs in their neighborhood, and I agreed to have some Klan members, two or three, stay at their house, sleep on the porch outside. They had a covered porch in sleeping bags, and if these Mexican gangs come around to shoot up the place, they could do something about it, defend the place. Well, of course, not to my knowledge, there was a police provocateur involved in the San Diego group. And he talked these guys into arming themselves to the teeth, getting into a car, and proceeding up the street to this place, which was not what they were supposed to do at all. And all of a sudden, the cops stop them and get them with conspiracy and all this kind of stuff. And a couple of them did, I don't know, 3-4 years in prison for it. And just because there was an informant and provocateur engineering that whole thing. So this is something that goes on all the time. And of course, like I said, at that time we used to have police radios, or I did, and I uncovered a lot of stuff by listening to the police radio. But these guys did not have a police radio. They had all their shiny guns in their car, but no police radio, or they would have known the police were onto them. Instead of spending $100 for a police scanner, they were spending all their money on guns. So that's another thing. That's the right wing. They'll spend every dime they've got on guns and very little on equipment that could protect them from observation or whatever. This kind of person lies convincingly in a Captain America truth test. There is folklore floating around amongst regular folk to the effect that undercover agents of the government must always tell the truth. After all, they will swear to tell the truth at the trial. They probably took some sort of oath to tell the truth, didn't they? If you catch them in a lie, won't that impeach their credibility on the witness stand and cause the case to be thrown out? This belief often leads to the provocateur's victims to inquire, are you a cop, or are you working for a government, the government in any way? The provocateur's answer, no, is often accepted as the correct answer to the G-Man truth test, the belief that cops, like Vulcans, will always tell the truth is surprisingly still out there, but losing adherence. Well, I was watching an interview with a New York police detective, and he was going on and on about, we don't have to tell the truth. We lie to everybody. We can lie. It don't make any difference. We're not under any obligation or any law that says a cop has to tell the truth. So an informant will lie all the way down the line, and then he'll, on the witness stand, he doesn't get in trouble. So if you're ever taken in for interrogation, they'll tell you anything they think might screw you up. I mean, they'll lie and they'll look you right in the eye and lie like hell. And they got all the evidence, they know this, they got that, and your buddy just gave you up and all that. And most of the time it's bullshit. And so remember that. Because they are trained and educated to lie. The agent, the informant wears a hat, okay? Funny, right? There is not a not-so-funny joke that floats around amongst undercover personnel that goes as follows. Quote, if you ever think I'm getting set up, I'm going to ask the guy to take his hat off and then look around and see if the cavalry rushes in, unquote. Taking off the hat or cap or other headgear has been a long-standing visual bus signal between provocateurs and surveillance teams. Not always, but more often than you would think. You might want to ask your newfound generous friends to take off his hat and let you look at it because you would love one just like it. So in conclusion, if you look at postings on a forum and consider if someone is in the discussion maybe an undercover cop, then instead of considering who is the silent lurker, avoid the discussion. Think more about the one who talks the most and makes the brashy inflammatory statements like kill or smash or blood in the streets. The one who tries to set up meetings and intimidate those who are peaceful, telling them that they aren't true patriots. The one who tries to discuss, provide, or email you distributing images or questionable links so that they can be retrieved later from your computer via a computer forensics examination to prove your deviance. Well, when the ATF came into my place here, they took three computers. And it's interesting, I had protection on the Mac, and it took them a long time to return my Mac, so they had problems getting into it. But if I'd have had criminal activity on those, or plans for criminal activity on those computers, I'd have been long gone. If you receive emails or Facebook messages after writing an article or making a posting, are some of them aggressive or pushing for violence and seeking your involvement, your input, or your reaction to their odd suggestions? You know, one trick they'll use, too, is they'll say, well, this guy's no good, this leader's no good, because he doesn't want to get his hands dirty. He don't want to get involved in violence. He's a chicken shit. He's a coward. Don't mess with him. Go with me, and we'll get things done. That's a typical thing that goes on. This is a sign of someone who has no fear of instigating and carrying out criminal activity because of his connections to those who would prosecute. They aren't always bullying high-pressure operators, suggesting violence, though. They also use the I'm your friend tactic to get a lonely or impoverished person or a substance-addicted person to nod his head or parrot provocateur statements, or to at least get the target to mumble something like, uh-huh, during an uncomfortable silence in a beer-drinking session after the provocateur has verbally mapped out a dastardly plan. That minimal recorded uh-huh has been a tool used against many, supposedly proving the defendants buy into the conspiracy. As a final comment, most countries of the world do not allow agent provocateur activity. It is expressly prohibited. Rather, it is an established legal principle that a lying government agent involved in criminal activity misrepresenting himself to the other parties cannot be excluded as a defendant in any criminal conspiracy that is charged as a result of his action. Otherwise, the validity of the assent of the private parties to conspiracy or the existence of the conspiracy itself would be in question. Being a lying provocateur is not an acceptable court defense. In those places for state actors who arrange to ship drugs, blow people up, shoot people, and so on, the U.S. is not one of those places. That just shows you that U.S. citizens are less free than most countries in the world. I think one of the biggest assets they have today is Facebook and chat boards. They don't really have to do a lot of footwork. They just sit by the oasis of the chat boards and wait for the dummies to come along. And like, you know, the major storefront and so forth. These are places where the feds will hang out, or I mean even locals will hang out, just waiting for a dumbass to come along that they can trick into something. And believe me, there's plenty of them out there that come on. I get a lot of emails from people that I want to get together with people. I want to do something, blah, 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 blah. So I send them the insurgent manual. That's about it. Say, look, you're on your own, baby. You build your own group, your own cell, or better yet, stay with yourself. And usually, that's the last I hear from them. That's the last I hear from them. They want to get together at a meeting. They want to go to a rally. They want to go to a march. A lot of these guys are innocent, but they just, a lot of them aren't. They just want to get the thin edge of the blade in first so they can get inside and do some damage. Well, the only way you're going to infiltrate yourself is if you talk in your sleep. And if you talk illegal activity in your sleep, and you got somebody writing it down, the lone wolf has got a lot of protection. And that's why we support lone wolf activity. Now, I'm going to send this out to you. It's very well done. I know it was a long read, but I'm going to send the whole thing out to you. Thanks to one of our lone wolves who knows the law. So there you go. Looks like Mitch McConnell from Kentucky trying the same plan that we've got here with our Governor Pence in Indiana, playing games with this Obamacare thing. When Mitch McConnell dropped Jaws last Friday by saying that the fate of the Kentucky neck and the health insurance coverage of over 400,000 Kentuckians is unconnected to the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, many wondered if he embarrassingly misspoke or if it was an intentional deception designed to fool voters into thinking that the popular state Obamacare exchange could survive without Obamacare. The KYNECT website and call center was paid for with federal money from the ACA, and specifically $252 million in federal grants. Without the ACA, Kentucky foots the bill for a website that is worthless. Over 300,000 Kentuckians gained Medicaid coverage because the ACA expanded Medicaid eligibility and Kentucky did not opt out. And that coverage is 100% paid for by federal money under the ACA until it becomes 90% after a few years. Without ACA, they are no longer eligible unless Kentucky changes their state law and pays through the nose to cover those new people. That is not happening. Most of the 82,795 Kentuckians who bought private insurance through KYNECT are able to do so with the help of federal subsidies only made possible by the ACA. Without ACA, their plans that have strong consumer protections on pre-existing conditions, not being dropped from coverage for getting sick and spending caps, are no longer mandatory. So they're gone. Gone as well is the requirement that children must be covered under their parents' plans through the ages of 25. Without the ACA, many of these people won't find someone to insure them, and many are forced to go back to junk plans that are worthless when you have a medical emergency, or plans that are unaffordable without federal ACA subsidies. Without the ACA, KYNECT is nothing but a worthless website that would soon go dark, and roughly 400,000 Kentuckians will lose their coverage and consumer protections it provides, and will therefore be thrown back into the old health care system that had failed them before. What McConnell is hoping to do with this strategy is deceive Kentucky voters who like what KYNECT is doing but have a negative perception of the Affordable Care Act, and hope that the media here will do lazy, he said, she said. Reporting that does not explicitly point out that what McConnell is saying is flatly false. Our lone wolf who sent this in added to this. In other words, McConnell is saying that the state exchange, which was created and fully funded by Obamacare, is not part of Obamacare. The state exchange itself is extremely popular in Kentucky, so he is now trying to support the exchange even as he continues to attack the program which created it in the first place and fully funds it, all the while hoping nobody calls him on the hypocrisy of arguing both sides of the issue. We see Governor Pence of Indiana is doing exactly the same thing here, And, of course, the press is totally controlled by the Republican Party in the state. The Democrats have no teeth, and so he's pulling it off. And he's making it look like he's not supporting Obamacare, even though through the back door he is, so that he can continue to get ready to run for the United States president. I'm telling you, you know, I used to always rag on the Democrats all the time. The more and more I closely observe the Republicans, I find them to be far more devious. And that's pretty hard to say, but it's true. They're far more devious than the Democrats. In fact, most of the time, the Democrats, with their whatever their perversion or whatever their craziness is right out in the open. The Republicans will totally talk out both sides of their mouth. It's terrible. And the people have gotten to the place where they hate the Democrat Party so badly that anything the Republicans do, oh, that's okay. You know, right after BP completed pretty much destroying the Gulf of Mexico and the environment and the occupations of thousands and thousands of people, I advocated that they be nationalized, that I don't care. Everything, no matter whether they're headquartered in England or not, whatever, they were headquartered here in the United States, should have been seized immediately. Because we all knew that they wouldn't do the job right. They could have done the job right. They didn't do the job right when the Exxon Valdez wrecked up there in Alaska, which that was a BP operation too. The ship that was promised, that was in the contracts, that they would have a ship totally outfitted to take care of that kind of a spill up there in Alaska, and when it happened, the ship was not even there, and it wasn't even fitted out, and it wasn't fitted out for the stuff no matter where it was, and they weren't fitted for it out there in the Gulf of Mexico to put aprons around this oil and collect it, thus destroying the crap out of the Alaskan shoreline. Now BP on Wednesday asked Supreme Court Justice Anton Scalia to allow the company to not make payments to businesses demanding compensation for the 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill while litigation continues. Now, you got to understand that Obama has given BP the go-ahead to start drilling in the Gulf again. And yet these people don't want to pay off the people they've destroyed. I mean, you see, this shows you who controls the system in Washington. It's totally bought and paid for. The company acted after New Orleans-based Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals lifted an injunction earlier in the week that had prevented payments being made. Last week, the court had decided not to revisit a decision rejecting BP's bid to block payments to businesses that could not trace their economic losses to the disaster. Scalia, who has responsibility for emergency applications arising from the Fifth Circuit, can either act on BP's request himself or refer the matter to the 9-member court as a whole. There is no specific deadline by which the court must act. In the new court filing, BP's lawyers say that if the payments are not blocked, countless awards totaling potentially hundreds of millions of dollars will be irreparably scattered to claimants that suffer no injury traceable to BP's conduct. Well, they can have a million lawyers operating in every court to block that so that the people who really got hurt down there don't end up with nothing. Plus the destruction of the Gulf of Mexico. Plus getting the go-ahead to start drilling again. The appeals court in March voted 2-1 to authorize payments on so-called business economic loss claims and said the injunction preventing payments should be lifted. BP already had said it would seek Supreme Court review of the ruling, you see. Just like the Supreme Court decides on who wins an election for president. They're totally in the pocket of these bastards. So if I was, you know, the people down there on the Gulf, I'm telling you, now, if it was me, the people down on the Gulf, if I were them, I'd arm myself to the teeth and take these BP people on. Because they're coming back down there, people. And they're going to screw you again. You know that. Everywhere BP goes, they leave rack and ruin in their wake. And don't depend on the feds to do anything about it. In fact, don't depend on the state even to do anything about it. Too bad Huey Long's not still around. He'd have grabbed everything that BP had he could get a hold of. He wouldn't let him get away with that crap. And don't forget about the big Mexican oil fields down there in Mexican national waters. They've got a tremendous amount of oil, and they got problems too. And who knows when something's going to blow up down there and flood Mexico, Gulf of Mexico, with more toxic trash. Americans just have not gotten the message of how badly their Gulf of Mexico has been ruined. And how it's going to be ruined for decades and decades and decades and probably hundreds of years because the press in this country is totally in the pocket of all the corporations. The corporate press are in the pockets of the corporates and they're not going to tell you the truth. Well, that's about it for today. I don't know whether you could stand much more bad news. But there's not much we can do about it. But one thing you know, you should know what a agent provocateur acts like. You should. If you don't know by now, I'm sorry. 14-5, and what do we say? Shut up. Oh, yeah. Stray Dog tells me I shouldn't call scummy white people white trash. We should call them what? What did he say here? Supposed to call them poor gene people. Poor gene people. Okay. All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Freya's Day.
God.